Our next speaker is Devesh Kapoor.
Thank you. I just want to begin by thanking Sir Atul and Gabe for a wonderful year. When you start a sort of fellowship, you always have these grand plans. And by the time you're ending it, you just wonder where the time went. I don't work on this, on the issue of the middle class either. So the whole point of this workshop was to try and get us, at least like for Gay and me, to get us thinking about a subject which we didn't know much about, and as much to learn from all of you. So in that sense, I suppose it's a pretty selfish sort of exercise. But I'll tell you this note, which I sort of wrote and which I've been thinking on, is this relationship between higher education, the professions, and the middle class. And I'll just take you through some of my thinking, and it's basically that. It's not very, very, very coherent, and sort of how I came to it and some of the questions which arise, which I have. And, you know, I don't want to say that middle class and professionals are sort of synonymous, but by and large, I think sort of historically we think of professionals as the quintessential middle class, although they are probably a sort of subset of the middle class. Now, my own sort of work in sort of economic development, and you know, now you see a fair bit of sort of literature and regressions run on the middle class and so on and so forth. And by and large, this literature basically focuses on the middle class by looking at mainly income or consumption in that sense. So it's about the size of the market, you know, how many more pairs of shoes you can sell, or, you know, can you sell more iPhones because there's a middle class that will buy it. So it comes a lot through that, the size of the market. And so the power of the middle class in some ways is somewhat reduced to its market power in some ways. And I'm sort of more interested, I suppose, a little bit on the middle class is the social power of the middle class, which comes from its dominance of the professions. And this comes from the monopoly of expert knowledge and the social prestige that expert knowledge sort of empowers. And through that, one backs sort of into higher education, because access to this knowledge is through higher education, right? So enter the professions through higher education. But whether and how certain professions acquire or get this social power, prestige, that depends on the how sort of professional groups with set admission standards, performance standards, and so on and so forth, which over time give it certain prestige. And in some ways, I suppose that higher education is a necessary condition, but the ability to organize in professional groups with set standards, etc., is sort of a sufficient, I don't want to say sufficient, but is an additional condition which you need in order to acquire and have this prestige that comes with expert knowledge. The other way I think that professional associations, they further politically empower the middle class is because they serve as a way of collective action of the middle class. And one way to think about it sort of recently is, if some of you followed, in Pakistan when Musharraf was ousted, it was led by lawyers, right? And if you see in a lot of colonial movements, lawyers' groups are often associated with that. And that comes both as, you know, because as lawyers you engage the colonial administration and courts, but also because through professional organizations, networks, all of that, a form of group identity in a different way through professional associations, it was an easy way to organize collective action. And, you know, if we think of groups like teachers, one of the reasons that, you know, normally if you see in work and political economy of reform, one of the sectors that is hardest like to change, I don't want to use the word reform, change is a more neutral term, is sort of teachers, is sort of education. Because teachers' associations are very, very vocal, well-organized, and it's actually a very hard sector to change. We know it in this country, but it's true in most places. So in some ways, I suppose if this reasoning which I've outlined has any sort of validity, then the power of the middle class will at least in part depend on how well the professional organizations, how well they're organized, how well they function. So in other words, it's more than just income, et cetera. If you have this social prestige, et cetera, through your professional associations, that is a way in which you leverage, in a sense, your social power, and through that, your political power. And one, of course, counterpart to that is if certain professional norms, in a sense, professional standards dilute, and with that, the prestige of that profession dilutes, that would undermine, in a sense, the power of the middle class through these functions. Now, for the past few years, I came to this by I've been working a lot on higher education in developing countries, and especially in sort of India. And the other part of my work has been on public institutions in India. And, you know, first we had some work on federal public institutions. And now I've been looking at what I call non-state public institutions and or institutions of civil society. And professional associations are a part of that. And the interesting thing about professional associations, and I have to say I only know this in the case of India, so I don't want to generalize, so I can only say of the Indian experience, is that professional associations always have some links with the state. In part, they have some links with the state because many of them have statutory recognition by the state. And the reason is sort of obvious is that any association with, say, for instance, lawyers or for doctors, you need some group that has some degree of like monopoly power to grant that degree, right? I mean, if all of us like, decide to award PhDs as opposed to a PhD is only award, can only be awarded by a university, it would dilute it, that term would become meaningless, right? So it's not that in the US anyone says that I form a group and we will be empowered to give someone and say so-and-so is recognized to be a sort of physician, right? Because if that happens, then standards, et cetera, become rather meaningless. So perforce, you actually need some monopoly bodies because you say only X group is empowered to certify, say, institutions or create the professional criteria as to who can be a physician. Otherwise, of course, all of us can go our own ways and say, well, I know what it takes to be a doctor, and I don't recognize you. So in that sense, it's interesting that, and this is true of accounting, if you look at a CPA, there is one CPA. It's not that there are 500 bodies that say we also give a CPA, right? So there is something intrinsic, of course, about professional degrees that you need sort of monopoly bodies that give this certification. Because they are monopoly bodies, they need some link with the state that allows them that monopoly, right? Because the state can easily say, we don't recognize you, we create our own monopoly. And that's why even though these professional organizations, we think of them as sort of civil society organizations, but they necessarily have links with the state. Now, what is interesting in sort of India is that you have professional bodies like architects, lawyers, doctors, etc., accounting, some of which are statutory and some of which are not. By statutory, I mean that an act of parliament has been passed which gives them this monopoly power. So only the Medical Council of India is the only institution that has can set up the standards to be a doctor and to say which medical school is allowed to exist. Only the Institute of Chartered Accountants. So if you want to be a chartered accountant, which is an equivalent of a CPA, it's only this body that can sort of certify. And one of the ways that I've been thinking about it is to ask, why do some professional bodies seem to perform better than others? And in some ways also to ask this broader question, at least looking at governance in India, where, you know, most people sort of dump on the state, etc. But what is interesting is how a number of range of problems of governance stem from the weaknesses of many of the professional bodies. And to give you an example of which we now sort of see, especially as markets become more important, is if you look at, say, issues of corporate governance, right, which you now see a lot of sort of literature. Well, corporate governance actually, its weaknesses stem a lot from the weaknesses of, because of the role of the accounting profession, the role of the legal profession, and interestingly enough, increasingly in some work which I've been doing, the role of academics. For instance, and the last is a good example, if you, India's biggest corporate scandal, is a huge scandal, was a company called Satyam. Now, many of these companies now have independent directors because that's required by law, you know. And many companies' independent directors, lo and behold, are academics. Now, what is interesting is that Satyam's board, the independent directors, were two people, like from Harvard. One was the guru of corporate governance at Harvard Business School. So, while being an independent director, was also made $250,000 a year, giving executive programs for the same company on which he was an independent director. You might think it's a slight conflict of interest. So I wrote to the deans of these business schools asking, what do they do? You know, what are their professional standards when something like this occurs? After all, the reason major companies have faculty from prestigious schools is because of the prestige of the school that attaches and the signaling effect that has. Right? You say Princeton, Harvard, Yale, especially in a developing country, right, where these things, the signaling effect is higher. Now, so I wrote to the deans of Wharton, Kellogg, HBS, sort of about their own, how they see the professional standards when you have something like that. And all of them, interestingly, had a very identical sort of reply, is that, Professor Kapoor, you have raised a very complicated question. Very interesting question. We will get back to you. Needless to say, that is not going to happen. But it's not about, you know, a particular thing. I think it's more about thinking about that we normally think of governance as something out there, especially we sort of link it as some thing called the corporation or the state. But I think that a lot of the weaknesses of broader weaknesses in governance also have to do with the role of professional standards and standards amongst the professions, because the professions in some ways were designed, and part of the prestige came initially at least from their self-governance. They were supposed to govern themselves. We set standards for what it is to be a sort of doctor, and these are things that are tolerated. Now, in India, for instance, if I've been looking at, say, fines, you know, how do they self-govern, right? So one is fraud, you know, outright fraud. And if you look at a whole range of areas, whether it's architecture or it's the bar, it's doctors, it's interesting. There virtually hardly anyone is ever debarred. India has 1 million lawyers. You know, 1 million people are part of bar council. It debars maybe 1 or 2 at most a year. And the fines for fraud are actually $5. It's still in law. It's $5, you know, 500 rupees. I mean, sorry, 250 rupees is the sort of fine. The same thing with if you if you practice as an architect and you're not a certified architect, and the Architectural Council of India, which has a monopoly on this, sort of finds out, it imposes a fine, and the fine is $10. Now, so the buildings might come down, people might die, but the fine is $10. So part of the thing is to see in some ways how the weaknesses of the professions in governing themselves, not only that is have a broader sort of ricochets on broader governance issues, but also how it shapes the social power in a sense of the prestige of the middle class. Because these are things we associate with the middle class. That's, in a sense, what I've been thinking about, but I don't have any coherent answers, so I'll stop.
Thank you very much. Those were two interesting presentations. Gay asked me to say a few words in my capacity to as chair of the panel, and then we will open it up for discussion. You know, I'm very happy that this conference is happening. The issue of class sort of emerges, reemerges, dies down, and then comes back. And the focus on political possibilities or political role of the middle class is a subset of a much older discussion of what is the relationship of class to politics, which has been around forever, so to speak, in social sciences. And whenever we talk about class to politics, that link, there is sort of always a sort of a structural objective element and a behavioral subjective element. Goes back to Marx, class for itself, class in itself, class for itself. And it's very interesting that the two papers we just had presented, one emphasized more the subjective element of classness, and the other emphasized its occupational, professional positioning. And this has been an old duality in the study of the class, of class, linking class to politics. And I suspect as we go through our discussion, we will see this duality come sort of over and over again, and there is no simple resolution for it. There's no right or wrong. It's just slightly different way of approaching it. I happen to have gone back to reread E.P. Thompson lately. Don't ask me why, but I did. And for teaching purposes. And when I reread E.P. Thompson, you get a very clear sense of when classes become communities, they almost look like ethnic groups, you know. So, and sort of remember old novels from Zola of miners becoming, you know, talking about mates and stuff like that. So class has indeed, what Yoshi's rightly drawing our attention to, a very strong subjective element, and she's providing us with a very nice framework for how to possibly get at in a more sophisticated, possibly quantitative manner, but certainly this has a sort of strong analytical tradition for thinking about class in subjective ways. On the more objective side, I think over and over again the question that will arise as we go through this conference, what on earth is the middle class, especially in the context of developing countries? You know, sort of, is it income category? Is it an occupational category? Is it a cultural category? Does it have relationship to the production system? Or is it, as I suspect, for many, just a residual? That it's not the bourgeoisie, it's not the working class, it's not part in the working, in the informal economy, it's not the peasantry, it's everybody else. If it is, that's not a good way to proceed analytically, but we've all been there before. But if it is, it has enormous variations across the developing world. That's one of the first things that will hit us. In Latin America and the rich middle-income East Asian countries, it probably is beginning to resemble what we may think of middle class even in advanced industrial countries, and possibly in Eastern Europe, I don't know enough about it, that they're urban, professional-based, income type of categories and white-collar workers or some element of that. But you go to India, and that category is fairly small. Suddenly the question is, what about the rich farmers? Are they middle class? Because the incomes are the same. So if it's an income category, what's the difference between a city doctor and a rich Sikh farmer in the Punjab? you know, they both drink the same Scotch whiskey and they both eat the same chicken, you know, and are they the middle class? If they are, their political proclivities tend to be quite different. So what is that based on? So there'll be that types of questions. But in general, thinking about if middle class is an objective category, how does it become politicized? I think we might want to, I suspect a lot of the papers we'll keep coming back to, are they directly politicized themselves, as Devesh is suggesting, professional organizations? Is that the main modus operandi? Or do they become politically significant because of their links to political parties? Is that the most important link? Or is it even more diffuse? It's through that they are the legitimacy creating classes. They are the chattering classes. They talk. They write to newspapers. They read. They create opinions. And in that sense, they help or undermine regimes in power. So there are very various possibilities. And maybe towards the end of our session, we will have some greater understanding of these issues. Thank you for good papers. And we are now open for questions.
No, indeed, these are the most important questions we will be asking. But I think in a way it's great that we start with methodological reflection, and we should thank you all for doing this. I think this is very interesting. It's a very old problem, right? I think, you know, I have this idea that the issues in social sciences are returning sort of 30-year intervals, right? Because the last time we had this discussion about the sort of nominalistic data and holistic theoretical concepts was 30 years ago, right? You think, you know, you look at the historical sociology and all the theories and analytical problems were holistic, assuming that there is something more to a group than a collection of individuals. And then we said, well, you know, but every type of data we look at, it's just purely nominalistic. Now, there are three ways around this, and I, you know, that discussion was not conclusive. There are three ways around this. There are a lot of efforts to do something about it. The one effort is to observe groups, and it was easily done in social psychology. Bales and others, you know, developed this wonderful schema, you know, how you observe group in action, right? So you don't really pay attention to individuals, but what the group does together. So now, is there a way to think about this for macro political issues? And I think it is, in a sense. So we can do three things. We can do macro historical research. When we pretend, by and large, that we observe groups in action, right? And macro sociologists and macro political scientists are sort of writing about revolutions and other things. This is like sort of, you know, we are observing collectivities in action now, right? So that's one approach which solves the problem of this contradiction between data and our concept. Now, the second is very good empirically. It's event analysis. You know, I say this because I'm involved in doing this kind of research, where you see what groups do, right? So, you know, you look at all the protest actions, strikes, demonstrations, and so on. These are not individual things. These are group actions, right? And you can have a very good empirical account of, over time, how those things can be done in different societies. And of course, you know, something that you proposed, look at the content, right? And I think, you know, anthropologists would say, well, you know, the way around it is to look at cultural products. You study the discourse, you study, you know, cultural products, and so on. You really don't pay attention to. But I think, you know, this is very relevant to the discussion because we'll be bumping at this issue again and again. What kind of empirical data we really have to say that, you know, this is middle class, this is working class, this is something else. One question for Devesh. It's a very interesting research project, and I'd like to join you in it if you want to expand your comparative perspective. Now, the important thing about professional associations, civil society, and the state is that the boundary between civil society and state is as blurred today as it's never been before. Not a single organization, almost except for, you know, some sort of, you know, skin groups and terrorist organizations and so on, has no connection to state. Most of the NGOs are at service of the state, trade unions, all the pacts, corporate arrangements and so on. So, you know, that boundary is not existing. Now, what is interesting about professional organizations is that they need that relation to have monopoly, as you call it. But they also want to protect their members. And in doing this, they go against the notion of meritocracy and openness in the political system. It's a fight in Eastern Europe, which is being played over the last 20 years, how much the state can allow professional groups, corporate actors, to protect themselves from competition. They came up with this, you know, incredible schemes how you can sort of, you know, have some internal exams to keep some of those lawyers away from, you know, earning good money and other lawyers earning big money and so on. So there's a lot of interesting things going on, but there's something contradictory in the notion of professional organization which we need to pay attention.
Thank you. What is the time frame, Gay? Prefer that we collect questions and then you can both give you both 5 minutes each or so. All right?
Other question? Yes, please.
Others define my group comes back to haunt me, comes back to haunt my identity, and then I position myself. So I'd like your thoughts on that. And related to the exogenousness, the issue of policies and how policies in a society impact upon that group's identity, as well as that group's goals and hopes. You might want to argue with me, no, it's the other way around. I'm provoking you to think about it from the outside in. Having said that, I'd like to move on to Devish and again say exactly the same thing that was mentioned earlier. This is an exciting part of the middle class work. And I congratulate you for looking at it. I'd like to share with you the experience that I bring up in the paper I'm presenting. And that is the informalization of politics of the middle class, particularly in professional associations. In a state-controlled society like Egypt, the professional associations are going through an incredible process of informalization. The Islamic Muslim Brotherhood managed to capture the professional associations. The state came in trying to control that and push the Muslim brothers out. The opposition within the professional associations decided to informalize its action and create blogs and create outside the profession groupings. And I think this is an interesting situation to look at as well. I don't know how much of it happens in India or Pakistan, but it is certainly something that I'm claiming informalization that here needs to be implemented. And finally, measurement, a question to both of you. I have just spent time with Yale and I realized that approach to individual or class, they look at the long-term, longitudinal development. I wonder how much of the life course research would help in the issue of ethnicities and identities, how much of the life course research helps understand professional identity.
Thank you. Patrick, and then Lynn White.
So, excuse my voice, but it's malfunctioning late. Atul has thrown out a challenge that I want to take up, because if the middle class is a residual category, then we might be in trouble, because it won't be entirely clear what it is we're actually talking about. And Atul might very well be right. I mean, certainly the way the concept's been used historically, it's this sort of the dumping ground for everything that doesn't fit into the standard conventional dichotomous category of labor and capitalism. But I want to try and respond and give a definition that I think is not a residual definition, although it still leaves out problematic categories like small farmers and small shop owners, et cetera. And I want to begin with a quick comment about why we talk about class. You know, I forget who said it, but someone once said in sociology there's three variables. Sociologists are preoccupied with class, and why are they preoccupied with class? Because class is the mechanism through which we explain that thing that we worry about the most in sociology, which is inequality. And class is, in effect, a shorthand, because class gets used in many different ways, especially when you get to Bourdieu, where class is really just another word for distinction or division or difference. Class is the mechanism through which we think about inequality. So what's the real definition of class then? Well, a class is a category that confers power. And the traditional definition, the type of power is capital. So you have the bourgeoisie and you have those who are dispossessed. But I would argue that the middle class just has another kind of capital, and a form of capital that's become much more important in the post-industrial information economy, and that capital is educational capital. Right? And this is sort of a conventional argument. Because if you think about it, what's a credential and property, they're both the same thing. It's a social relationship that's enforced through the state, through power relations, through laws, through institutions, through various mechanisms. And so maybe what differentiates the middle class, at least in its most clean-cut version, which, and I agree with Devesh entirely, that professions really epitomize what the middle class is that it has monopolized this particular capital called the credential. Right? So I do think looking at professions, their boundaries, why some are more effective at hoarding that opportunity called the credential than other professions is really a critical area of inquiry. My question for Devesh is just to push him a little to say a little bit more about why you think the different professions would have different degrees and capacities of hoarding certain credentials. That is, why is one profession more successful in what Bourdieu calls the classification struggle than another profession? And for Yoy, my question would be, could we really, given at least historically the fact that we've used class as this sort of heuristic device to think about power and how power is conferred across categories, could we really treat class the same way we treat ethnicity and gender and other social divisions?
Thank you. That's right.
One of the papers, I think I should address this mainly to Professor Herrera, and it's really the same as each of the three previous questions, but put in perhaps the form. I was impressed listening to the presentation that you're moving to from adjectives and nouns about ethnicity to verbs. Each of the four, which is, if I put it in rather grammatical form like that, each of the four categories of ethnic content had, at least implicit in it, a verb, I thought. Just to list them. What norms constitute a group? What political goals does an ID, an identity serve? That I think is the most important of them, and I don't get to the main question. What other groups do people compare themselves with? And the fourth one, with what cognitive processes do people presume that identity will be used as? I've got two closely related questions. Can you prioritize this list? And to put it more specifically, isn't the second of those categories prior to the others. That is, the question, what purposes does an identity serve? Doesn't that come up before the other three do? And related to that, has any surveyor tried to measure somehow the strength, I'm sorry, that's a noun, how strong ethnic identification is, in terms of activities? That is, for example, the strength of traditional Muslimness versus the more modern Muslim identity, the strength of Taiwan, Taiwanese identity is versus more mixed, let's say, Chinese, Taiwanese, American identity. I'm Californian before I'm an American. To measure identity not just in terms of an attitude survey by which you're asking people to self-categorize themselves, but in terms of what people have done by somehow strengths shown by activity. And this is just to end with a footnote. Wang Wuhu, an historian in Southeast Asia, wrote an essay, I think, some time ago about the overlap between class and class activities in Southeast Asia and ethnicity, especially relating middle class activity to Chinese ethnicity. Joining business federations, for example, implies things about income and certainly about class, but also very strongly about ethnicity. But my main question is it number two on your list, really, the one that trumps the others? And if anybody tried to measure strength by activity?
Thank you. Dave? I'm sorry. Gay and then Amani.
I will just tag on to Patrick's question, and I want to push Devesh a little bit again. So in your paper, you give these really startling figures around the changing, which I know nobody has had a chance to read, but the figures that you give for the changing number of people, or the changing percentage of the population of developing countries who graduated from universities over the last 20 years, it's really dramatic. So I wondered if you wanted to speculate a little bit about how those changes educational
credentials
create new pressures on those professional bodies and
what that
might mean for
middle class
politics and
securities.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Just really briefly, I've been thinking, I don't work on the middle class either, but I've been thinking about these issues.
Does anybody?
But I've been thinking about these issues, especially in relation to the Arab world. And my question to you is how would, and the way, something that's made sense to me as I thought about this question is that, you know, again, there are these things that categories, it's not necessarily ethnic per se, or it's not necessarily capital per se. I mean, you can, within professional classes, have people with different interests. So I wonder about how this idea of articulating, defining your interests vis-a-vis the state can structure class categories, meaning within even similar categories, you're going to have different interests based on objectives, goals, maybe identity. I don't know, but that's, I'll put that out there to mess things up even more.
One of the participants who left the room asked me to read a question. What percentage of the population is organized in professional organizations in Pakistan and India? Is it feasible to identify other interests in the society for grassroots actions? Did you have your hand up, sir? Last question, and then back to our...
We're looking overseas, so we're very much interested in the long-
Thank you. There are lots of questions. Time, as always, is limited. We will give each of these 2 or 3 minutes in reverse order. Devesh, you go first this time, and then Yoshi. And please self-limit yourself. Regular, self-regular. 3 minutes.
You guys get 1 more minute as sort of organized. starting with some shaggers, yes, absolutely. We should do something. But I think the question you raised is something which reminded me, they reminded me this morning about the exclusionary power of professional groups.
Speak in the mic.
Gay reminded me this morning of the exclusionary power of professional groups, and she gave the example of the medical profession in the U.S. And part of professional organization always try to do is essentially preserve certain professional rents, so to speak. And I think the example which Gay gave was how the medical profession in the U.S. organized in the 19th century to try and exclude these sort of midwives out of it. And partly it was also sort of gender issue, sort of which overlapped. It's interesting that this issue of professional organizations now are struggling with this in very different contexts. To give you 2 examples, one is that since the professions are quintessentially in white-collar services, and white-collar services, unlike the past, which were treated as non-tradables, are now more tradable. They are tradable in 2 ways, and I'll give you examples to illustrate. One is through immigration. And so if you look at if you look at the immigration of doctors and nurses like to the US, it's the states like Nebraska, et cetera, where there are few physicians who press most for it. It's the American Medical Association which fears the loss of overall rents for its existing members that is most opposed to it. In India, it's the opposite. You find that because of the huge success of Indians in skill migration, especially in the IT sector, they're all for skill immigration and countries opening up their borders. But the Indian sort of legal and accounting profession is very afraid of skilled immigrants coming to India in the legal and accounting, which is what the US is much better at, and diluting their existing rents. So in that sense, There's a lot of work now that is going on about under what circumstances do countries recognize professional credentials outside their borders, right? And part of it comes to what extent it is about standards and how much of it is about protecting existing as barriers to entry, in a sense, and protecting your sort of rents. The question about the counterpart to the Muslim Brotherhood, it's actually interesting. This also relates to the question which Patrick raised. So in India, the capture comes from a different rationale. And this capture is, if I look at, say, 3 professions, the accounting profession, medical profession, and the legal profession. So you have the Bar Council of India, the Medical Council of India, and the Institute of Chartered Accountants. All 3 were statutory bodies created by Parliament. The general sense is that the accountants have done a much better job in preserving their professional standards, not the lawyers and the doctors. And the reason, and the question is why. And my, at least, research, I argue is that the Bar Council and the Medical Council, they have the... under their laws, they certify new medical and law colleges. Till the 80s, these were all in the public sector, so it didn't really matter. From the 90s, there's a massive private sector expansion. So what that means is that certifying has now become a huge money-making operation. That, you know, I basically get paid off millions of dollars to say this medical college is... I have certified. What that has changed is the elections to the Bar Council and the Medical Council that, quote, the good doctors, et cetera, and lawyers can make their money in any case. So now it's become captured by those who want to capture the certification process so that they can make money. So it is a form of capture, but it's not a religious capture. It's a capture in a sense in the usual rent-seeking way, because the chartered accountants don't have that mandate. So it still has, is their, you know, presidents, secretary are still people who are well-respected in the profession, whereas in the bar association and the medical association, these guys, you know, would probably not be able to pass a medical exam or bar exam if you ask them now to, you know, their quality is much lower. So in that sense, it's interesting how these broader incentives shape and ricochet back to the professional organizer. On Gay's point on this massive increase of higher education and its sort of implications, this I'm more tentative and I can sort of speculate. I think one thing which I'm seeing, at least in my work, is that higher education is now really where distributional conflicts are playing themselves out hugely. You know, what used to be land in the 50s, 60s, at least in countries like India and so on, that's where, you know, in India and maybe South Africa a little bit, you see, in Brazil, so affirmative action is one way in which these distributional conflicts are playing themselves out. And that is particularly the case that you see there's no one really cares about the median higher education institution, because that's not where you make the rents. It's the elite higher education institutions that you see, because that's, you know, when you have massive expansion, you have dilution of the signaling effect. So the action is shifting more and more to the very top, you know, or elite educational higher education institutions, and who gets in and how, and that's where these conflicts are coming.
Well, I don't have time to answer every question, but let me just try to get to a few. On the issue of other actors and the state and identity formation, I think you're exactly right that there are, if we're looking at the question of why identity groups form, what is important to them, et cetera, other actors are very important. I have a kind of maybe only just satisfactory response, which is to say that I think that by looking at what groups say about themselves and what issues are important to them and what kind of contestation there is, you will in some ways bring in other actors in the sense that states are doing things, other groups are doing things, but also events like a natural disaster, an earthquake or something like that. Groups are always having to respond to exogenous influences. I guess in a little bit more satisfactory way, I would say somebody like Evan Lieberman and Pranav Singh and this data set they have specifically on the state and the role of the state and state policies in the development of ethnic groups over time in a number of countries is very important, because everybody would recognize that, you know, legalizing groups, recognizing groups, adding them to the census, various kinds of legal discrimination or not, these kinds of things obviously matter to the group. But also other groups, whether what other groups say, don't say, et cetera, norms within other groups, just, for example, intermarriage. You know, some religions will allow you to marry other groups, some wouldn't. This has an effect on your relations with those other groups, obviously. So I think that it's a very good point. And just we try to address it by talking about contestation and discourse within the group to maybe bring some of that in, but that maybe could be brought in more explicitly. On the issue of life course, I think temporality especially is important to class in the sense that when you look at somebody at a point in time, students are the most obvious example, a student working at McDonald's, a Princeton student working at McDonald's, what class are they, right? And that's where occupational category would fail you, because it doesn't suggest this what happens over the rest of their life. On the issue of given class's relationship to inequality, some may say exploitation as well, can we treat class like ethnicity or gender? You know, I actually think you just have to say in this case that it depends. I think with gender you can make a much stronger argument. Why not? If you're talking about power, inequality, and exploitation, why not think about class and gender? Ethnicity, I think it really depends, because some groups are exploitative of other groups and some are not. So just take in Russia, you have what's called the small peoples of the north. These are small indigenous groups. They're not particularly exploitative, either towards each other or towards other groups. So can we think about those groups like class? Maybe not in the way that we think of ethnic Russians vis-a-vis the Chechens or Jews or other groups within in the country. So I think there maybe, I guess I would still stick with this idea that if you disaggregate types of content, you may be able to get to some kinds of links between some types, some ethnic groups and class and some not. But maybe in the broader sense, what I say, ethnicity equals class, no. But there can be some kinds of exploitation or inequality related to other groups. Same with religion, I guess I would say. On the issue of prior, which of these types of content comes first, I think it's interesting, let me just say this verb analogy, because I was reading something of Eric Wright's recently where he said, do not talk about class as a noun, only talk about, use class as an adjective. So that is class interest, class position, class this or that, not class as a noun, to get away from this overall what is class question. But I hadn't thought about moving to verbs, so I'll have to think about that more. On what comes first, I really think it depends on the group in question. Because, for example, gender. Can we talk about shared goals? I'm not sure we can. Maybe in a specific feminist group or in a specific type of organization, you have a shared goal. But in general terms, are there goals? I'm not sure. With nationalist movements, goals are often very closely connected. But some other ethnic groups that maybe are not nationalist movements, that are not national groups, even national identity groups, there may or may not be shared goals. So I'm not sure that, I'm not sure I would say one comes first. I think it really depends on the group. I think we thought about this question a lot. Are there some groups that are associated with some types of content and others that have other types of content? And ultimately we sort of gave up on trying to pin those down, because for sure class and gender, for example, have this relational comparison. It's almost impossible to think about them without relational comparison. But then again, so do a lot of other ethnic or religious groups. Almost all groups have norms. But to the extent there's less intersubjective shared understanding, there's going to be fewer shared norms, right? Because there's less policing, there's less consensus on what constitutes the group. So that I don't know. On the issue of, has anyone measured the strength of ethnic identity by looking at activity? Yes, and that I think goes back to Jegorsh's point. Also this work of Kanchan Chandra's that I mentioned. And it gets back to Jegorsh's point about this repetition of history. Because in some ways, I think what's happening in comparative politics with ethnicity is people have, especially I think Kanchan really deserves credit for pushing the debate forward by saying, look at all these studies we have supposedly of ethnicity, but what are they actually studying? And theoretically, they're not even studying what they claim to be studying. And we need to really scale back on what we mean by ethnicity. And what she has done is say, I just can't even begin to talk about what it means to be subjectively, what is shared about being an ethnic group. And let's just look at what they do. And in particular in India, let's look at whether people vote for ethnic parties. Let's look at whether ethnic parties exist and whether they vote, whether the party platforms have some kind of ethnic, broadly conceived content. So that's one way of saying, what do they do? And at least then we would have a notion that here are some groups that have a connection to politics in a very concrete way, in that they have parties that represent their interests. So that would be one example. I think event analysis, looking, do groups organize? Do they get out on the street? That's another way. So I think there is work along those lines, and it tends to be more discrete, which maybe, you know, theoretically maybe it's a better way to go, because at least you know what you're studying, even if you're not covering everything. And finally, I think I'll just end it there. So,
thank you very much. I'm afraid I wasn't a terrific time manager here. We are a few minutes late, but it's a very good start. Not every question got answered. My apologies to those. The question on whether these are good investment opportunities or not,
yeah.
Our participants will charge you a small fee. You can talk to them outside. We'll meet for coffee.